And I hope to give you an idea of what, at least some idea of what's happened in the last couple years and why, unfortunately, we can expect to see the same thing happen again. To give you some motivation here as to why we need financial derivatives, suppose that you are going to produce oil from the oil sands. And you need to sell oil for $60 a barrel to break even. You're designing some large oil sands plant, and your break-even cost is $60 a barrel. And you're concerned that the price of oil is going to drop below $60 a barrel. Now, over here I have the spot price of oil for what, the last 10 years. And you can see that there's a huge bit of time when the price of oil is less than $60 a barrel, right? Now, of course, notwithstanding that, let's flip back here. Notwithstanding that, you can see recently we have a big spike in the oil prices, up to almost $100, then back down again, $140 a year and a half ago, back down to about 40 and back up to 100. So again, you're designing some oil sands plant that's going to run for 20 or 30 years. You're very concerned that the price of oil is going to drop below $60 a barrel because you're going to lose a lot of money if it goes below $60. Most of these oil sands plants need that kind of price level in order to survive. So as insurance, you're going to buy put options on oil, spot price of oil. So what exactly is a put option? Well, a put option gives you the right, but not the obligation, to sell oil at a strike price K of $60 at some time T in the future. Again, to reiterate here, the terminology that people use in this game is, I'll refer to K as the strike price, and big T is the expiry time of the option. Okay, so these sort of put options can be viewed essentially as financial insurance. So if S of T is the spot price of crude at some time T, if S at big T is less than, I think I'll try using my hockey stick here. If S of T is less than the strike price, you can exercise this option and effectively get paid $60 a barrel for the oil that you produce. On the other hand, if the spot price of oil at some time, big T, when this option expires, is bigger than the strike price, you don't exercise the option. That would be silly. You just sell oil in the open market. Okay? So this contract pays off at some time, T equals big T, the following way. We can just think of this as a contract. You don't actually have to buy or sell any oil. It just pays off some value. And its payoff is the maximum of the strike price minus the spot price and zero. So if the spot price is below the strike price, you'll get paid, and effectively you'll sell oil at this locked-in price of $60. If the spot price is bigger than the strike price, then this option is worthless. You'll just let it expire. Okay? So effectively what's happened here is buying the put option is essentially buying financial insurance, and basically what you've done is locked in a minimum price that you'll receive for the oil, right? In this case, $60 a barrel. So this would protect you against the spot price dropping below $60 a barrel. Okay, so we can think of options then as being financial insurance, right? So this is a simple example of a derivative contract, which is a put option in this case. It's also known as a contingent claim. And in this example, the spot price S is the price of crude oil, but you can have endless other possibilities. So for example, you could have oil, electricity, the TSX index, or, for example, more recently, defaults of subprime loans. These are possibilities that you can use as the underlying asset in a derivative. This example I've just showed you basically shows or illustrates how you can use options as financial insurance. Again, you can't think of these things as a fundamental gamble, right? They're basically economic purposes. Again, don't think of it. Thing that you don't know that's going to happen in the future. As you buy house insurance or car insurance, these kind of derivatives are basically just financial insurance. I've just shown you what a put payoff looks like, so that's protection against the spot price of something dropping. You got a question there?
Yeah, I don't know. It's okay to have questions or you
would... Why not?
Yeah. Okay, so you've explained how the insurance works, but in insurance, there are usually some restrictions on who can buy it and who can sell it. So, for instance, I can't buy insurance, fire insurance on my neighbor's house.
But, for example, in the United States, you can buy their life insurance policy.
Well, that's also controversial.
So again,
it's not obvious. So you explained why
you can reinsure is where essentially they're buying insurance policies.
Yeah. What you haven't explained is why there should be a completely open market.
Well, it's the same reason you have reinsurance. You have reinsurance is a market, another market to reinsure an insurance company's policies, right? It's supposed to spread risk around. That's the idea, right? So when you say people do buy and sell insurance all the time, right? So, okay. Yeah, well.
Who can pay off?
Yeah.
Right, well, so if you have people who can't take delivery, I guess.
That these things should be traded on exchanges. That's why you have exchanges, right? They would ensure the delivery of the value of this option, right?
But not of the oil. You can't, yes.
Well, we're really getting far away here. Most of these options, of course, aren't actually settled in terms of the underlying commodity. It's settled in terms of cash, So moving right along now. So, of course, you can have a call payoff, which is a payoff in terms of the maximum of the spot price minus the strike price. So in that case, that would be protection against the price of something going up. You can have straddle payoffs, which is basically protection against the price moving at all, away from the strike price, and so on. So you can have endless other possibilities. Okay, so what is something like this worth, right? So how much, if I'm going to go and buy one of these put options from a bank, how much is the bank going to charge me for a put option? Okay? Well, not surprisingly, in fact, the bank, or it shouldn't be anyway, in the business of taking risk. They have a very simple philosophy. They want to make money regardless of what happens to the price of the underlying asset, right? They're not supposed to be gambling. They're selling insurance, right? So it's supposed to be reinsured somehow. So what happens here? The bank sells me the option at some price today and hedges its exposure to me. So I'm buying the option. I'm buying some insurance. And the bank, what it does is basically hedge that risk. So how does that work? So let's go through this sort of zeroth level model that really started quite a long time ago. Let's let S be the price of the underlying asset, say the TSX index. A standard model for the evolution of the asset through time is given by what's called geometric Brownian motion. This dates back to 1973 or even before. Okay? And the basic model then is to assume that DS over S follows this stochastic differential equation, right? Without this term here, this would just be some sort of exponential growth. The interesting part of this equation here is there is a random term. So phi here is a random draw from a standard normal. Okay? And sigma here is the volatility, the sort of measure of size of that randomness. And you note the interesting square root dt here, which occurs for these kind of Brownian motion stochastic differential equations. So this is a stochastic differential equation. It doesn't have a particular deterministic solution. Right? It has only a possible set of outcomes. So, for example, here are sort of 10 possible realizations or paths of geometric Brownian motion. For example, suppose we start at $100 today, and we look at what can possibly happen in 1 year. Then, in fact, we can see that, you can't say there's one particular path that this asset will follow. There's only a spread of possible outcomes, right? So the asset may end up here in 1 year and may end up down here, and there's some spread of possible outcomes. So what you see here, in fact, just 10 realizations of possible paths in the future. Okay. So, by the way, note that we haven't assumed, you often hear in the press that, well, we no such thing as a rational market. Well, we're not assuming that prices in the market are rational, right? They're just prices, and they don't have to have any relationship to anything. The only thing we're assuming is that they are basically unpredictable, stochastic. Okay, so why is that a reasonable assumption? Well, if the price process was predictable, me and lots of other people would eventually be able to determine any patterns in the data, right? In particular, if this was possible, I would be rich and I would not be speaking to you today. So you will observe that I am, in fact, speaking to you today, so you can draw your own conclusion from that, right? Okay, so again, we're not thinking that the markets are rational. They're just unpredictable, okay? We're not pretending that people do things rationally. Okay, so let's get back to this bank here. What are they doing? Well, the idea of the bank is they will hedge their exposure to me, right? So let's let V of S and T be the value at any time of the option, okay, that the bank's going to sell me. What the bank does is sell the option to me for some price. So that option is a function of the spot price, and time today is zero. And the bank's objective is to construct a hedging portfolio, which I'll call pi here. And the hedging portfolio consists of negative the option. Negative means they're short. They've sold me the option, so they owe me something, right? And then they'll buy E units of this underlying asset at price S and put some money in a risk-free bank account, right? So S, you remember, is the price of the spot price of the underlying asset. B is a risk-free money market account, and E is the number of units of the underlying asset. Okay, so what happens here? So this goes back to the basic idea of hedging, which comes about from this famous paper written in 1973 by Black, Scholes, and Merton. There's actually two papers. And Scholes and Merton got the Nobel Prize in 1997 for this in economics. And the idea basically is quite simple. The idea, what does hedging mean? Hedging means that I want this portfolio, the change in this portfolio over some small period of time, so pi at t plus dt minus pi of t, that should be zero. That's what a hedge is. So a hedge means that the change in my portfolio is zero over some infinitesimal time. Okay? And remember, pi changes randomly, right? Because it's part of the underlying asset is part of this portfolio. Both the option value that I'm short and the underlying assets that I own, that's going to evolve randomly. So if you think about it, this is kind of a bit of a trick here. You want to try to figure out how to make that portfolio change zero, even though the underlying asset changes randomly. Not so obvious how to do that, right? Well, you do a little bit of stochastic calculus and make through a little argument, and you can show that, in fact, the value of the option, this so-called no arbitrage value, is given by the solution of this Black-Scholes partial differential equation. Okay, a sigma you've seen before is a volatility. S is the underlying asset price. These represent the partial derivatives with respect to the asset price. T is time, and R is the risk-free rate of return, whatever the government's giving you today for short-term bank account. And it turns out that the optimal number of units of the underlying asset turns out to be dV by dS. This is the choice which minimizes the hedge error. Okay? Again, it's quite a clever, very elegant argument used to derive this equation, and certainly when you see the argument, you can think, wow, that's very clever, and that's certainly something you see right away why you get a Nobel Prize for that. No, it's quite easy to understand, and it's very clever. Okay, let's go back to the bank. So what does the bank do? The bank solves the Black-Scholes equation today and sells me the option for this price V at whatever the spot price is at time zero, and then constructs a hedging portfolio pi by buying E units of the underlying asset and taking whatever's left over and putting it in this money market account, the bank account. Okay, what happens? Well, time evolves. Time goes to T plus DT. S goes to S plus DS, and remember that S moves randomly, so DS is random. At T plus DT, the bank rebalances the hedge by buying or selling the underlying asset, so that now E at S plus DS, T plus DT is equal to dV by DS. So I've rebalanced the hedge by now buying and selling the underlying asset. So at the next instant of time, I still have dV by DS of the underlying asset. And this is called delta hedging. The portfolio is called delta neutral if you do this thing. So this hedging strategy evolves continuously over time. Okay, this is a dynamic strategy. It's rebalanced at infinitesimal time intervals. It's self-financing. In other words, once the bank collects cash from selling the option, right, no further injection of cash into this portfolio is required. So that's what you mean by self-financing. At some time, big T in the future, the bank liquidates the hedging portfolio, pays off the short position in the option, and at zero gain or loss. Okay, it's kind of miraculous, regardless of the random path followed by S, right? So this is kind of a miracle, if you think about this, that I can sell this option at this price, I can go through this strategy here, and regardless of what happens, whether the price goes up, the asset price goes up or down or whatever, at the end I'll have exactly enough money in my hedging portfolio to pay off the option holder, pay off any bank loans, end up at precisely zero, regardless of this random path followed by the asset. Okay? This is really, sorry?
What are you thinking about drift coefficient and the...
Okay, amazingly enough, the drift coefficient disappears from the equation.
What are you assuming about the...
Okay, so we're going to criticize this model. Next few slides. Okay? So we're going to go through and tell you what doesn't work and what works about this. Okay?
In time, or are they
sigma could be a function of time or asset price. Essentially, the same thing would work. It doesn't matter. Hold your horses. Okay. So the value of this object, this is 1973 we're talking about, okay? And then I'm going to move up to 1976. I know. This is 1973, okay? And this is now 2011, so this is 1976 we're doing here, okay? So the value of the option is the no arbitrage value. This is called this hedging cost is this no arbitrage value. So we can think of the value of this option as the cost of heading up the hedge. It's not the expected value of the option. It's the cost of setting up the hedge. Okay? So does this actually work? Can we construct a hedge so we can't lose regardless of the random path followed by the asset? Okay, well, let's test it out and see. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to simulate a random price path. And along any path, I'm going to carry out delta hedging at finite rebalancing time, so it won't be a perfect hedge, because the times at which I rebalance will not be infinitesimal. And then I'm going to liquidate the portfolio at expiry and pay off the option holder and record the normalized profit and loss. P&L is the terminology used in this game here. So normalized profit and loss is the actual profit and loss divided by the initial option premium. So some kind of dimensionless measure of how much you've made or lost along any particular path. And I'll repeat that many times, right? And I can do that. I can then develop some kind of probability density function of what I observe here. Okay, so here's the Monte Carlo simulation of this delta hedging strategy. And here's a put option, and this is 40,000 simulations here. So this is the profit and loss along this axis here. So negative being a loss, normalized loss, positive being a gain. And this is rebalancing once a week, which is not that often. And you can see here's the density of that distribution, peaked about zero, as you might expect, but significant probability of making or losing money. Again, remember that in hedging, our objective is not to make money or lose money, it's to make exactly zero. Okay? That's our objective. And so what happens if we rebalance twice daily? Well, of course, it gets more peaked. And if you keep on going, yes, in fact, you find that this probability density collapses to essentially a delta function, right? So in fact, it does work. This theory does, in fact, work. You can check it out yourself, and it does work. Okay? Okay. So let's move along. What happens in reality? Well, of course, nobody hedges at infinitesimal intervals. Volatility is not equal to constant. GBM is not a perfect model, right? All kinds of things wrong with this. And not last but not least, the bank wants to make a profit. The bank, in fact, does not actually want to end up with zero. They want to end up with something positive, right? So, for example, if you look at any sort of exchange-traded option, and you might compare it to the Black-Scholes model, and you'll find, well, gee, it's actually, if I want to go buy that option in the market, you'd see it was the Black-Scholes model price plus epsilon 1 and epsilon 2, two components. If you wanted to sell that option into the marketplace, you'd find that the price you would get would be the model price minus two components. Epsilon 1 is the profit the bank wants to make. They're not doing this for fun. They have to pay for their bonuses every year and their expensive cars, right? So that's where epsilon 1 comes about. And epsilon 2 is the compensation because the hedge won't be perfect. Well, you don't hedge in infinitesimal time periods. Volatility is not constant. Geometric grounding motion isn't correct. So you put some of the other factor in there to fudge it, so to count it to give you some compensation for that. Okay, so if you look at what it costs to buy and sell options in the market, right? Buy minus sell price, the buy will be bigger than the sell price. That corresponds to what's called the bid-ask spread, right? So in some sense, you can see the bid-ask spread gives you an idea of how liquid the market is, because that will make epsilon 1 smaller. And if the option is very exotic and unusual, because people will be worried about how good the model is, epsilon 2 will be bigger. Okay? Okay, so what's wrong with geometric Brownian motion? Well, lots is wrong, right? Everybody knows that volatility is not constant, right? So here's a slide showing the VIX index, which is the so-called implied volatility, which you compute from on the S&P 500. This goes back about 25 years. So this is the implied volatility from options which are traded every day kind of thing on the index. And interestingly, you can certainly see that most of the time it hovers around 20%, but you can look at this immediately, you can see when bad things happen. When bad things happen, volatility becomes a lot higher, people become very nervous, right? This is 1987, you remember there was a big crash in 1987, you can see this huge spike in the volatility there. This is .com, right, which lingered around for a lot of years, but caused a lot of noise. And here's the subprime crisis, right? So you can just see from this. Now, the other thing to observe from this, by the way, is that you got something repeating itself about every 10 years or so, right? So it's not unusual to have these kind of crisis-like events, right, every 10 years, right? And I'll return back to that in a minute. That's the thing to remember is that, well, certainly volatility is not constant. Some bad things seem to happen every 10 years. So volatility, in fact, is actually stochastic. So if you flash forward from 1973 to about 1980, now you go to stochastic volatility models, which were fairly popular and also used quite frequently these days. So you can actually have another equation, the stochastic differential equation represents the evolution of volatility, and you can go through the same argument, and you can figure out how to price and hedge options based on that. That's fairly straightforward. I won't bother going through the details. It's the same idea. Use some stochastic calculus. The hedging portfolio becomes a little bit more complicated, but essentially the same idea. But there's actually a worse problem. So the fact that volatility is not constant and is stochastic is not the biggest problem. Again, that's a fairly simple extension to this basic model. That can be handled fairly easily. So what's more wrong with geometric Brownian motion, other than the fact that volatility is not constant and stochastic? So if you examine return data, you'll see that the market has sudden jumps in addition to geometric Brownian motion. A jump is a sudden discontinuous change in the price. Brownian motion is a continuous path. Jumps are in a discontinuous path, right? So that's something vastly different from geometric Brownian motion. Geometric Brownian motion plus stochastic vol is still continuous price graph, right? But with a jump, that's actually quite a different kind of thing, different animal. Well, think about this from a risk management point of view, right? You sold options, you sold credit default swaps on subprime loans. If there's a jump in something, a parameter, now you're really exposed to a huge amount of risk, right? So this is very important from a risk management view to sort of think about what does it mean when you have jumps. Conventional wisdom, well, we don't care about jumps because they're too expensive to hedge. Right? We can't make any money if we worry about jumps. So most people ignore jumps, and these are these market crashes, which you see every once in a while. But again, I get back to that slide. Well, you can see that we get some kind of financial crisis occurring about once every 10 years. Last 30 or 40 years, something bad happens about once every 10 years. So it's not that unusual, is it? Does it make sense to ignore these events? And jumps, if you want to know their sort of popular name, if you look at that book by Nassim Taleb there, it's called Black Swans, black swan being a sort of a word or a phrase to indicate some very unusual event, right? Well, it's unusual in the sense that, well, it doesn't happen every day, but it happens every 10 years. It's not that unusual, right? So you know this is going to happen. In the words of the famous former Secretary of Defense, this is a known unknown, right, as it were. Okay, well, again, you can see these pretty often. Here's an example of a drug company stock. This is a log scale on the left here, right? And you can see what's happening in one day. The price went from $28 down to $6. And then a few days later on, it went from $7 down to a little bit over $3, okay? So this would be impossible with geometric Brownian motion, right? If this was geometric Brownian motion, this pattern would be observed only once in a time long compared to the age of the universe, right? So it's clear that geometric Brownian motion does not capture a lot of what you see in the market. Here's another example. Here's the S&P 500 log returns from the year 1982, or over the 20-year period, 82 to 2002. And I've also scaled this to zero mean and unit standard deviation. And on top of this, I also have a standard normal written down here. Okay, well, you can see that if geometric Brownian motion was perfect, things would kind of fall nicely under this normal distribution here, standard normal. Actually, what's interesting about this is there's two things that are interesting. In fact, geometric Brownian motion isn't that bad, right? For a zeroth order model, it captures kind of a, well, broad range of what's happening, eh? It's not so bad. However, immediately you can see there's some funny things is that you've got these big outliers here, right? These big market crashes, which occur every once in a while, are clearly much more common than could ever be rationalized by geometric Brownian motion. So just to sort of reiterate here, what's the bottom line here? Extreme events are more likely than simple GBM. We have a higher peak and a fatter tail in a normal distribution. And you'll note, by the way, this does not include the market crash of 2008. That would be like setting up a straw man here if I put that in there. I literally just picked some 20-year period. And you can pick any 20-year period in the last 100 years, and it looks like this. Okay? So it's not as if this is an unusual event. So you take any 20-year period in the last 100 years of the stock market data, and you see it looks like this. Well, geometric Brownian motion gives you some rough idea, but then you've always got these big outliers. So you just have to look at the information, and that's what you can see is happening. Okay? So it's not a surprise at all. Okay, so here's a better model. Now we're going from 1973 to 1976. Okay, so it's not as if Mr. Merton, which was the one of the co-winners of the Nobel Prize there, didn't know there was a lot of stuff wrong with geometric Brownian motion. And again, well, I think he was concerned, saying, well, what's the biggest difference between geometric Brownian motion and reality? And the reality is these jumps. Okay, stochastic volatility, non-constant volatility, that's a minor tweak. What's really different is the fact that you can add these jumps, which are discontinuous changes, price changes, not continuous changes. Okay, so here's your simplest possible model of a market with geometric Brownian motion with jumps laid on top. So here's the our change, ds over s. Here's the geometric Brownian motion part, exactly as I had before. I've got an extra term here now, which models the jumps. So dq is a Poisson process, right? And it's zero with probability 1 minus lambda dt, and 1 with probability lambda dt. Okay? Lambda here is the mean arrival rate of this jump process. And when the asset price jumps, it goes from S to J times S. And J is a random jump size. So there's a couple of random things going on here. There's a random arrival time, which you can characterize by some lambda. And there's also some, when the jump occurs, its size that it occurs by is also some sort of random parameter, okay? So this is geometric Brownian motion plus jumps and has the obvious name of a jump diffusion model, okay? So again, you can do a lot more sophisticated things here. This is just the simplest possible model which adds jumps. So it retains the geometric Brownian motion part, which handles 80 or 90% of what you see in the market, but adds this important extra term here which says, oh, every now and then you've got a big sudden change, okay? Okay, so clearly then this simulates the idea of a sudden market crash, right? And this is a very simple model of a sudden market crash. Okay, so what are the ramifications of this? Well, let's do our same little exercise here, simulating the price paths here. So I'll go through here again and simulate 10 realizations of GBM plus jumps. Same parameters before, except this time I'll use my arrival rate is point of the Poisson jump process is 0.1 per year. So what that means is that only on one of these 10 paths any given year, I'll expect to see a jump, right? That's exactly what you happen here. You see that what GBM plus jumps, geometric Brownian motion plus jumps, jump diffusion, says that most of the time, the asset follows geometric Brownian motion. And every once in a while, and this time, one-tenth the probability of every year, you get a big jump occurring. And there it is right there. You get a big jump, and then it goes on with geometric Brownian motion. So that's basically what a jump diffusion process would look like. Most of the time, it looks like Brownian motion. Every once in a while, you get some jump occurring. Okay. Well, again, in this case, it gets a little more exciting to solve the option pricing problem. I haven't actually mentioned this, by the way. I've described a European option, which is an option which you can only exercise at the expiry time. In fact, most options which are traded on exchanges are so-called American style, which means you can exercise them at any time. And in that case, the option price, the no arbitrage option price, because the solution of this so-called Hamilton-Jacobi-Bellman equation, which is a partial integral differential equation. You notice I have this integral term here. This happens because of the jump process. And I have this min of two sort of operators here, and that's what happens when you're solving an American option. Okay? So from a computational point of view, this is certainly a little bit more challenging than the plain Black-Scholes model. Right? So you get this integral term due to the jump process, and you get this min of these two things due to the fact that I can exercise the option at any time. So I'll do the holder of the option will do the optimal thing. So that's why I get the min of those two things equals zero. Okay. By the way, just a little technical note for the fans here, more mathematical things. This is actually a Hamilton-Jacobi-Bellman variational inequality that I had in the previous slide. This is a nonlinear partial integral differential equation. In general, solutions to these equations are non-smooth, they're not differentiable. So you may ask, what does it mean to solve a differential equation, which is not differentiable? But in fact, there's a fairly nice theory about this. This is based on the idea of a viscosity solution. Right? So it's a sort of a generalization of what we mean by the solution of a differential equation, when in fact, the solution may in fact not have derivatives. And the challenging part here, from a computational point of view, is to design algorithms which ensure that you will converge to this viscosity solution. Okay? It's quite easy to construct examples where seemingly reasonable methods will converge to the wrong solution. Okay, so let's get back to my example here. Well, suppose the real world follows jump the fusion, okay? And suppose you work at a bank, and you convince your boss that you don't have to worry about jumps, sudden changes in market parameters. For example, sudden changes in default, subprime default rates, right? So you sell put options and use this simple delta hedge. Okay, this is a thing that you learn in a fourth year undergraduate course in finance. You learn how to do delta hedging. You use the constant volatility Black-Scholes equation to compute the delta hedge. Again, this is fourth year finance, first year MBA stuff. Okay. And the way this works is, well, everybody knows that constant volatility isn't quite right, but there's sort of approximation that involves, well, you back out what's called the implied volatility from current prices, and then you construct your delta hedge based on that information. So the volatility actually changes. It's marked to market every day, calibrated to the market, and you use that to construct your delta hedge. Okay, so it's a way of approximately taking into account the fact that volatility is not constant. So what happens when you do this? Okay, now note, this is the wrong model, right? I'm assuming that I know everything about the world here. So I'm assuming the real world follows my jump to fusion model. Okay? But you're at the bank, and you convince the powers that be that, well, there's no such thing as jumps, and you construct a delta hedge, you sell options, and construct a delta hedge based on this simple constant parameter Black-Scholes model with no jumps. What happens? Okay, before I get to that, I'm going to, first of all, remind you what the profit and loss probability density looks like for delta hedging, where the real process is geometric Brownian motion. So in this case, the real process is geometric Brownian motion, and I'm doing the correct, theoretically correct thing. What does that profit and loss diagram look like? Looks like this, right? This is the normalized profit and loss, okay? So the real world's following geometric Brownian motion. You're doing the delta hedge, which is theoretically correct as the hedging interval becomes quite small. This is a daily rebalancing of my hedge, and you can see it's quite peaked, about zero, as you'd expect, very small probabilities of profit and loss. This is the same diagram I had before, but I've rescaled it, okay? And we're going to see why that rescaling is interesting in a minute. Okay, now let's flip back to this second example where the real world follows jump diffusion. You follow this geometric Brownian motion delta hedging strategy. Again, this is the wrong model, okay? Let's see what happens. Okay, now what's happened here is the peak of this distribution here has got shifted over to the right. That's a profit. Okay? So what that means is that most of the time, you make money. And, of course, the price to be paid for that is what? The price to be paid for that is now we have this huge tail of losses, of enormous losses to the left. Okay? So, again, let me remind you what's going on here again. Real world follows a geometric Brownian motion with jumps. You assume that's not the case, and you construct your hedge based on Brownian motion. Most of the time, you make money doing the wrong thing. Okay? This is highly significant when you think about this. Okay? Okay, again, let's look at that tail, which you can hardly see on that plot. I'll just zoom down there again. Well, here's my geometric, here's my sort of what happens most of the time. This huge density goes up here. It's positive. If I ignore this tail to the left, it's positive. And I have this huge tail that goes down to the left here. It goes way down to the left. In fact, there's a parameter way to sort of characterize tail losses. That's called something called conditional value at risk. So the 95% conditional value at risk so-called CVAR is about minus 4 in this case. In other words, the average of the worst 5% of the tail losses is about 400% of the option premium. That would be considered extremely large risk, right? Conditional value at risk here. Okay? Let me just go back to that previous slide, by the way. Remember that what's really happening here is this is the stuff that only happens once every 10 years, right? So if I'm running a hedge fund, right, what I'm going to show you is what happens in the last 5 years, and it looks like this, right? All you see is steady, small, positive gains. I mean, you're not in business anymore if this ever happened, right? If you are in business, you're only looking at this part of the curve, okay? So next time you look at those hedge fund returns, I want you to think about that. Yep. It's actually negative, but again, who cares? Okay, I'll explain to you why you don't care if you're working at the bank. This is exactly it. Okay? Most of the time, if you're going to the delta hedge, which is the wrong strategy, you will make small gains. Now, what you should be doing, right, in any real rational world, right, well, maybe not so rational, you should put these gains in a reserve fund so that you will be able to use the reserve when a jump occurs. If this was real insurance, being regulated by some real insurance body, this is what they would make you do, right? Okay, so you've hedged away the small random exposure. You haven't hedged the big jump, so you should put that money into reserve fund so that you're still solvent when a jump occurs, when a crash occurs. Again, I'll remind you that the current data suggests that crashes occur once every 10 years. So this is not an unusual event for these kind of things to happen, okay? What actually happens, okay? Well, if you ignore the tail risk in our toy example here, the mean of the tailless distribution, if I just ignore that bit there, because, again, I'm in this business until that happens. So before that happens, it looks like a positive mean, right? Again, most of the time, you make money. So what do you do? If I have a scheme and I say, oh, well, I can show my investors, I say, oh, look at this. I can make a small amount of money with almost zero risk. So how do I make more money? I borrow, I leverage, right? I leverage up, I borrow a lot of money to invest in this strategy, magnifies these small gains. And again, for 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 years, it works perfectly out. I make a lot of money. Your boss is happy, right? He looks good. Your shareholders are happy. They see this steady return every year, very low standard deviation, looks good. And of course, not to mention yourself, you get paid a large bonus, right? Okay, this goes on for some time, right? Again, looks to be 5, 10 years, right? Which is infinity in the finance industry, right? You're collecting million-dollar bonuses for 5 or 10 years. You don't care what happens after that, right? Then a crash occurs. What happens then? Well, you retire rich, right? Because they don't take your bonus back. Shareholders and the taxpayers pay for the losses. This is a perfect strategy, if you think about it. Works perfectly for the guys in the bank. Of course, when you're interviewed afterwards, you claim, well, this was a totally unforeseen event. It was a Six Sigma event, which is true if it was geometric grounding motion, but of course it's not. Everybody knows it's not geometric grounding motion. This should only happen once every 10 of the 6 years, etc. You've heard all these guys give these talks, right? By the way, is it difficult to hedge jumps? Well, actually, not that difficult. You can actually design a trading strategy which can protect against jumps. Okay? And what are the interesting problems which occur? Well, we don't know when a jump will occur. We don't know how big the jump will be. Okay? Well, it's fairly challenging. But again, you think about the extension of the Black-Scholes philosophy. The Black-Scholes philosophy was design a hedge so whatever happens to this random event, make everything cancel out, and I can figure out how to do that. Same philosophy here. You can follow the same philosophy. You can design a hedging strategy which does not require good estimates of the jump frequency or the jump size. You want to make your hedging strategy as insensitive as possible to those parameters because they're hard to measure. Okay, so a good hedging strategy will not be sensitive to the jump frequency or the jump size. Okay, so this involves, you can solve this an HJB equation and solving an optimization problem, but you can actually do this. Now I'll just put a little plug for myself here. A couple of papers that we've written, myself and my colleagues, really describe how to do this. And it works reasonably well on whatever data we've got, some realistic data. It's robust to bad estimates of the jump frequency of the jump size distribution. what's wrong with the strategy? Well, it's better insurance, right? It's going to cost more. It doesn't cost that much more. It costs about 10% more. Yep.
Continuously rebalance. Would this be a perfect hedging?
Yeah, but of course, you can't do that. Right? Transaction costs would kill you. So effectively,
all you ask is that the standard deviation or some measure of risk that you want to take, right, is sufficiently small. That's your objective, right? The objective is not, in reality, it can never get zero, right? So you just want to make it small. What's acceptable, kind of thing. Okay? So you can reduce this jump risk to very small. So your density distribution, unless you do that, will not look like that thing with the big tail. I'm going to eliminate that big tail, right? So if you can do this, the insurance is better, so it costs about 10% more. Well, nobody does this, right? Because that would cut into your profits, right? If you were to charge 10% more for insurance and the guy down the street is charging 10% less, you're not going to get any business, are you? Right? So you can't really propose something that would cost more, even though it's better insurance. Okay? So nobody does this. Okay, let's go back and think of what's happening in the market the last few years. There's recent large-scale bailouts of financial institutions were caused by poor hedging of credit derivatives in particular. Actually, everything else worked fine, right? You've all heard about credit, subprime, foreign exchange, equities, bonds. They all worked fine. There was no problem with that stuff. It was only the guys in the credit division that caused everything to blow up, right? Okay? There was no allowance made for sudden changes in model parameters, in particular default rates, you know, correlations and so on. There was no hedging of jumps in this case. Absolutely not. That's always these amusing quotes that these guys make here. Charles Prince, CEO of Citigroup, explaining why Citigroup was aggressively involved in selling credit default swaps. As long as the music is playing, you've got to get up and dance, right? As long as everybody else is doing the same thing, everybody else is making money, you've got to do the same thing too. Otherwise, your shareholders will eat you alive, right? If that guy down the street's making a whole bunch of money, why can't you make that much money? By the way, I'll just remind you here that Prince received a $105 million exit payment. Citi shares lost 80% of their values. Warning bells about this kind of thing have been sounding for years. This is a paper we wrote in 2002, right, almost 10 years ago, talking about some of the complex contracts being sold by Canadian insurance companies. Basically saying that if one adopts this no arbitrage idea, we could detect that, in fact, insurance companies were not hedging these risks they're exposed to, because the prices they were charging couldn't possibly pay for a hedge. Okay, so it was easy to determine that, in fact, they were not charging enough for these contracts to actually hedge them. So again, that's kind of like selling fire insurance and pocketing the fees as a profit. It looks good for a while, right? We wrote this paper back in 2002. What happened? Well, here's the Globe and Mail from 2008. This is Manulife here. Manulife is in town here. Discussing about how there was a sudden drop in Manulife's shares. They posted a large mark-to-market write-down. In other words, their balance sheet was hacked because of the losses they were exposed to, because the big market drop gave them a huge exposure to the derivatives they had sold, the insurance they had sold. They were particularly called these things called segregated fund guarantees that they'd sold. And basically, here's the quote again, concerns of the market sell-off will translate to future losses. Basically means that the share price of Manulife went drop way down. Concerns were a result of Manulife's strategy of not fully hedging the products. What a surprise, right? Again, you could figure that out in 2002 because they couldn't possibly be charging what was really required to sell these things. And here's another one of these hilarious things, right? So the CEO of Manulife in 2004 decided not to hedge these products. Everybody knows the stock market always goes up, right? What's the point in hedging these things, right? Interestingly enough, the board of Manulife awarded him $25 million in 2009 for extraordinary performance. Okay. And the pain continues. 2010, right? 2 years after the market meltdown, Manulife is still having trouble. Well, I guess they better increase the prices and hedge more stuff, right? It only took them 10 years to figure that out, right? After they lost billions, okay? By the way, I have to give full disclosure here. I actually own some shares in Manulife. Somehow, you know, it's funny that when your personal investing strategy is never what you actually know in your head to be true. So I actually own, if anybody thinks I'm making bad things here, I actually own shares. I've seen go down the last few years. Okay, so let's get down to the bottom line here. Are mathematicians and computer scientists to blame? This is in the popular press. These guys are complicated models. They don't know what they're doing, et cetera, blah. For this crash, well, let's review what we know about reasonable models for financial assets. Black-Scholes model, constant volatility, 1973. You notice it's 2011 now, right? So things have moved along. If you were to read things in the press, you would think everybody's still using that. Nobody's using that model anymore. Jump diffusion, 1976. Yeah, we know there's jumps. Also known that for 30 years, 35 years. Local volatility, non-constant volatility, maybe 1990. That was very popular. Stochastic volatility equals jumps, 1995. It's been around for 10, 15 years. Unfortunately, most common models used by banks are maybe local volatility, maybe a little bit of stochastic volatility, never any jumps. Nobody ever uses jumps. So you ask people, you know, I've given this talk many times to people in industry, why don't you use jumps? Here's the standard reply. Jumps models are too hard to calibrate. Take you a little bit longer to figure out how to match the parameters to market because it's a little bit harder computational problem. Jump models take too long to compute. Traders want to be able to hit the return button and get a price, right? Because they're making deals all day, right? Jump models which give prices which are too high. Why do you suppose that is? Because it's better insurance, right? But again, you get this problem is if I'm going to sell something more than the guy down the street, my boss is going to fire me, right? You can't make any money selling something more than the guy down the street selling it for. It's too hard to hedge with jump models. Yeah, you have to do more work, right? Okay, with jump models. What's the reality of this situation? The reality of the situation is that it's in everybody's interest to ignore this model. If you ignore jumps, you will generate bonuses for yourself and your boss and your shareholders temporarily. Okay? So it's not as if people don't know exactly what's wrong with these things. Right? But it's in everybody's interest except you and me. Everybody who works at these banks, it's in their interests to convince people that, oh, it's Brownian emotion. Because again, remember that most of the time you make money if you assume that. What are things like in the financial sector today? Well, in any normal industry, if they just blow up like this, you'd think that things would be bad for a long time. You know, the auto industry, Japanese imports, things were bad for a long time. Well, here's an interesting fact. At a recent conference on computational finance, I talked to my friends at the reception afterwards when we were drinking some beer. And we're all sort of equally surprised. Well, what are your recent PhD graduates doing? Well, they're doing just fine. They have no trouble finding jobs in banks. This is last year, okay? This is 2 years after the biggest kind of meltdown, disaster any industry has ever seen. It's all back up and running again, okay? Business as usual. Bonuses are being paid. They're all back to pre-crash level. It only took 2 or 3 years. Bonuses are now at record levels, right? New products being sold, new ways to hide that tail risk being manufactured even as we speak, right? Okay? This is kind of amazing when you think about it. So what's going to stop another meltdown from happening again? And the answer is nothing. Because it is in the interest of bank executives and traders to underestimate long-term risks, right? Anything in that tail there, if you can shove it away, if you shove it away a bit, that means that in the short term, you'll make money. So if you can push it away somewhere that you can't see it, for sure you're going to make money over the short term. There's a compensation here, right? You get paid big dollars to be optimistic. The more optimistic you are, and the more you can convince other people that things are fine, the more money you make. So there's a natural inclination to do exactly what everybody wants. Everybody's telling you this, you'll get paid a lot of money. So here's an interesting fact. Did you know that Citigroup, under various names, because it's gone belly up several times, has been bailed out by the U.S. government 4 times in the last 80 years? Okay? And again, you can look that up in the New York Times. Okay? So again, not as if we haven't seen these bailouts happen before. Okay? Again, I've just given you very simple-minded little toy examples here. It's very easy to devise trading strategies which give distributions similar to that shown in our toy example. Okay? So you can construct distributions, trading strategies, which again, until the jump occurs, look very good. For 5 years, for 10 years, I can show you a track record that looks very good. And it's pretty easy to design these kind of trading strategies, right? And I'm not making anything up. It's not like Bernie Madoff, right? I'm actually doing these trades. I'm actually making money consistently for 5 or 10 years. The price to be paid, of course, is you've got to pay for this someday, and there's a big, huge loss, right? Again, why do I care about that, right? I've made my money for 5 or 10 years, and I'm out. I don't care. So one could argue that bankers are simply maximizing their own welfare by taking advantage of the Bernanke put. And you know what that is? What's a Bernanke put? Well, put, you remember, is insurance against something going bad intermittently. Well, what this is, well, you can do whatever you like if you work at the bank because you know the Fed will come in and bail you out eventually, okay? Because you're too big to fail. So we are likely to see another banking sector meltdown in 5 to 10 years. Right? And by the way, what's depressing about this is I give the same talk every the first lecture of this class I teach every winter. I gave it last year, and I expected people to get all sort of surprised. Then I'm seeing these guys in the front. They're all taking very careful notes about this stuff. Because, again, the thing is, oh, this looks real good. I've got to go get a job at a bank and do exactly this, right? The problem here is that every time this happens, right, it gets worse because everybody knows what's going on here. You've got to get in there fast and make your money fast. So you construct one of these strategies. You better leverage it up as much as possible. Get your money and get out, okay? And every time one of these blow-ups has happened, it gets bigger because there's more and more leverage involved. So unfortunately, the next time around, it'll be even bigger, right? Nothing seems to really have been learned, okay? There's nothing, no regulator, no governor of any central bank is really putting anything in here to stop this kind of strategy. People talk about things like saying, oh, well, we'll delay the paying the bonuses for 3 or 4 years. That actually was happening at Bear Stearns. They did that for years. And the consequence, you just simply asked, you said, I only got paid my bonus for 3 years. Well, does that make sure my bonus is 3 times bigger, right? And these guys aren't stupid. They didn't expect to get it in 3 years. Whatever they wanted now was all they cared about. So you can't do these simplistic ways of trying to handle this will not work at what all. And I think that's the end of my story.
Okay, so any questions? First of all, let's start with people on the phone.
You know, this is very interesting because it explains something that I never understood. This is more of a comment than I have a question.
Right, right.
Many years ago, I went to a physics colloquium that was on economics, right? So, and I had always heard about this Black-Scholes equation, and I never knew what it was. I was very curious to see what it was, and I said, well, this is just Brownian motion. How can anyone possibly take this seriously when we know that the market, we know that economic things are discontinuous? There's something called Levy Flight,
sure,
which might
sure,
be a
sure.
better
and that, that's,
is that what you're...
Well, that jump diffusion is sort of a simple case of that, right? Yeah, you can have these so-called infinite activity jump processes and so on. You can layer on top of these things, sure, but that's a little bit more advanced model than that. But basically, again, this is the simplest model which has this property of having these discontinuities, right? And then even with that, you can exactly see how to game the system, right?
Like you've explained it. They did know all along that
yes.
this was not a good
sure.
game. It's just a con game that they're pulling on.
Well, okay, so there's two classes of people. You might say there's a class of people that really knew what was going on and just played the game. And there's only a big class of people that thought that they were just smart. Right? Now, but you think about that. So how can a guy go and take an MBA class in finance and learn about delta hedging, which they teach you in like the second week or something like that, and then go off and get paid millions of dollars, which is what's going on, right? Now, economically, there must be something wrong with this, but, of course, these guys thought they were just smart, right? So, again, my encounter with these two classes of people, there's a lot of people who thought they must be smart because they were getting paid a lot of money, therefore they must be smart.
There must be in the dishonest class because they're convincing all the others to use this
model. I don't think the CEOs know that, right? The CEOs are not, you know, somebody would tell them. Somebody, their risk management guys would tell them that everything was fine, right? And then it looked good, and they were making bonuses, so they didn't really question this right.
But how about the academics? Why weren't they looking at your work and saying, this is obviously correct?
Well, certainly.
Why didn't that become the dominant view?
Well, I remember you give this talk, okay? You give a talk to a bunch of guys who work in banks. They say, well, you're saying we should sell stuff for 10% more than the guy down the street.
But suppose you give a talk to a business school. Shouldn't they be saying, oh,
yes. Remember those guys that said we're making the notes in my class?
So is every business school is teaching what you're teaching, and then they're going to...
No, they're teaching this Black-Scholes thing.
Oh, why? Yeah.
And the Black-Scholes thing is that it works. Their graduates make a lot of money for a while, and they give them big donations. I mean, it works for a while, right?
And you can ask, again, you see, this requires some kind of heavy-duty regulation, because you can't sell something for 10% more than the guy down the street. You'll go out of business. So you're going to go to the lowest common denominator when people are selling insurance for cheaper than it really should be sold for. So how do you counteract that, right? And remember that they're making a huge amount of money for the length of time that they're in business.
I have no problem believing that the people who run the banks are thoroughly dishonest, but I'd like to believe that some of the people in the academia who are working out these theories are.
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff in academic literature if you looked at it, you know, saying exactly the same thing for the last 10 years. You know? But again. Probably not, because a lot of people were too busy, you know, raking in the money themselves, were they? But there were certainly, if you looked, you could have seen it, right? It was there all over the place.
So they're getting money too somehow.
We're all under pressure with grants and so on, yeah, right, sure.
I have two questions, a mathematical question and a finance question. The mathematical question is this. When you showed when the banks make adjustments weekly as opposed to twice daily, the standard deviation of the distribution changed, but it remains symmetrical.
Yeah, you can sort of, well, this is about a geometric grounding motion case, right? You see what happens with the jumps, it became very skewed, right? It was extremely non-symmetrical, the jumps.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, my question is, why does it become so asymmetric when you have the jumps? Because you might consider the jumps to be a limiting case as you adjust your portfolios on a longer and longer time scale.
Basically what's happening when you do this delta hedge, right? The delta hedge is basically handling the small random changes, the Brownian motion. So that's why you get that collapsing of the, but it doesn't do nothing about big changes, right? So big changes will cause you a big loss in your hedging portfolio. So that's kind of the probability is a small probability of huge losses in your hedging portfolio. Every time a jump occurs, which is a rare event, but every time it occurs, you get a big loss. Okay? Whereas the delta hedge actually eliminates the small random changes. That's why that collapses down, but it leaves you this tail, right?
If you went from making the adjustments twice daily to weekly to monthly to yearly, when you get to the yearly stage, the differences would be so great from one adjustment to the next. Would that not be similar to having a series of jumps?
You could kind of think of it like that. It's certainly the case that if you hedge very infrequently, the distribution becomes more asymmetric.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Oh, it becomes asymmetric.
It becomes asymmetric, yeah.
Do you assume all the jumps are negative?
Nope. And if you think about it, you might say, oh, does it matter what you see? You're hedged. Hedge is like the first term in a Taylor series. So the first derivative is zero. So regardless of which way the jumps go, your hedging portfolio will lose money. Okay? You have to think about this a bit, okay? But it's not the case of assuming that the jumps can be either be positive or negative. You will lose all the time because delta hedge says the first derivative of your portfolio is zero. So it's the big changes from some trend that make a change. And remember, we're hedging. Hedging means we're supposed to get zero. We're not supposed to lose or make money, right? Okay? So it doesn't matter which way the jumps go, you'll lose on a hedge.
Here's my finance question. How many more of these cycles do you think the North American economy can go through
one more
before it can't recover?
I mean, obviously the last, I mean, look at the, so the 10-year ago one was this long-term capital management, right? And that was a big blow-up of a hedge fund, right? And that was, I don't know, $10 billion. And this one is $600 billion, right? And again, unfortunately, what you see again is once you know how this game works, you're just going to pile. The minute you see something, like you construct one of those payoffs, you got to get in. Everybody else is doing the same thing. It's a competitive business, right? Everybody else is jumping in there to try to make that small amount of money, so they're going to leverage it up as fast as possible, right? So you saw that happening with the subprime thing, right? So the next time around, whatever commodities, whatever the next big thing is, people are going to go in there even faster and leverage it even higher. And at that point, there won't be enough money to bail these guys out at that point. So the next, I mean, if you just look at the trend is it gets bigger and bigger. And you can see why. You've got to get in there faster and make your money faster. So I don't see anything really to stop this.
Yeah. So I've seen another explanation. I'm not sure it's actually incompatible with what you said from what caused this crash. So the question is it incompatible, and what are the actual numbers? So the explanation that I've seen is that there's been a kind of uncontrolled growth of the financial industry, in that that the kind of values that are attributed to it are fake, right? I mean, they're just paper values, and the total value of all the derivatives and whatnot, all these things is, I've seen figures like $500 trillion worldwide.
That's a bit misleading, because that's not the net. That's like some of the absolute values of all the positions, right? That number that people quote. If you actually net it out, it's much, much smaller. That's kind of one of these alarmist kind of things. Yeah. Let's face it, fundamentally, you know,
these things have economic value, right? Your pension plan uses derivatives to hedge your pension is using these as insurance, right? So fundamentally, these things do have economic value. The trouble is that you can game the system like this, right? And so these derivatives are useful, and the fact that you can trade them on exchanges means that you can offset risk. Other people can buy and sell these things. It's actually economically reasonable. Okay.
If you didn't use this wrong.
It's like several orders of magnitude less. You actually net out all the positions. Okay, so it's not quite that bad. I mean, I think fundamentally the problem is that distribution. I think that distribution with that big tail kind of shows you everything you need to know. I mean, it's a huge incentive to construct trading strategies, investments, whatever you like, that have that distribution. Because you can show that to people for 5 years, it looks great, and everybody's going to want to invest in it.
So you don't think that there's really much more, there's a lot of fictitious capital involved? In other words, it's not backed by any real...
I don't think that's the real problem. The real problem is that, think of it, it's like selling house insurance and pocketing the fees without really doing a proper reinsurance scheme, right? Which again, when was the last time somebody's house in your block burned down? You could collect house insurance for 20 years and it would work fine, right? And then it would blow up and then, well, you'd better be a VO at that time, right, when that happens, right? But that's fundamentally the fact is that this is an insurance scheme. It's not really
well thought out. I think that's the real problem.
But that's my opinion.
So do we have any questions from remote sites? Now would be the time. Okay. I guess not. In that case, let's thank the speaker.